I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama and a bipartisan group of lawmakers are huddling today on Afghanistan. Meanwhile, a meeting takes place tomorrow at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, to look into one of the deadliest battles of the war. We told you yesterday about the Battle of Wanat. A year ago, 9 U.S. soldiers were killed when militants high on a mountain attacked a small outpost the soldiers were trying to establish lower in a remote valley. One of the soldiers killed was 24-year-old platoon leader Jonathan Brostrom. 3 investigations have been launched into what happened. Tomorrow's at Fort Leavenworth was ordered by General David Petraeus last week, all because the father of Jonathan Brostrom, retired Army Colonel David Brostrom, began asking questions about his son's death, ultimately accusing his son's commanders, including a close friend, Colonel Charles Plaisler, of negligence. Colonel Brostrom joins us now. And Colonel, we want first and foremost to say we're so sorry about the loss of your son.
Thank you for your condolences.
Well, and regarding your son's death, you take issue with the initial Army investigation, which you say failed to point out that your son and his platoon were essentially alone, no support to build this new post, no construction material. They filled sandbags for walls. They had no water. What did the initial report gloss over, in your opinion?
You know, you read through the soldier statements and you start picking up shortages of defensive material, heavy engineers not arriving, which were critical to build this combat outpost.
Well, they were afraid. They were afraid to come and deliver the construction materials.
Yes, that's what they say. Nobody really knows for sure because nobody really checked to see the reasons why they were so late.
Well, and you say you got a hint of problems. When your son came home on break and showed you a video of his platoon shooting at Afghans around a campfire that was just a pinprick way in the distance, but in the same spot where your son's platoon had killed insurgents earlier that day?
I mean, I asked him, I said, how do you really know these are insurgents? There could be some family members from the local village coming to pick up the bodies, which they always do. They light a campfire, either to pray or whatever. And that's, you know, that's when he said, well, we know they're bad. And I said, well, I disagree with you. If you really can't tell me they were bad, then there was a chance there could have been innocent people there, then why did you attack them?
And you're a former military leader. At that moment, what are you thinking to yourself about your son's leaders?
Well, you know, I wasn't there. But if I had been there, I certainly would have questioned doing that. This was planned, and it means that it had to go through the company and battalion commanders. So, of course I questioned the leadership. To me, it doesn't seem right. And that's why this investigation hopefully will take a look at some of those issues.
Well, and now you'll be on your way to Fort Leavenworth to meet with the general that General Petraeus has ordered to look into the battle in which your son was killed. And as we said, you've had to, you know, call out a close friend, an active duty military officer. Here's an understatement. This must be difficult.
It is, but you know, when you lose a son, those feelings become secondary. And it's not just about my son. You had an entire infantry platoon rendered combat ineffective, an entire well-trained, reinforced infantry platoon that was decimated. And it was treated as just another day in Afghanistan. And to me, that just doesn't sit right. There should have been more due diligence done in the investigation.
Well, and we understand at least one effect of that battle a year ago is that the Army has been rethinking and the military has been rethinking these outposts, that in fact they're not maybe doing what they were supposed to do, which is stop insurgents from traveling over from Pakistan. And yet some of the outposts are still there.
Well, I think it takes time to pull back. But I'll just tell you, when I saw my son's combat outpost, and here is a lieutenant, brand new to the Army. Okay, he's highly trained in the usage of weapon systems and leading soldiers. What he was not trained to do was to engage with the local population, which is tribal. My son received zero training on that type of deal. So you would take a look at these pictures, and here you have 24-year-old Lieutenant Jonathan Brostrom sitting in churras with 60-year-old men, village elders, who had survived years of pestilence, famine, and disease. These guys are very cunning. They're very wise. And, you know, I immediately looked at that and I said, well, I know who's going to win here. So when you give the mission to your junior officers like this, you're really hanging it out. and your battalion commanders, the guys who are supposed to be doing this, who have the experience, they are so stretched. And so you had my son's battalion, that battalion commander had to cover down on 13 to 20 combat outposts, which is pretty hard, pretty difficult task.
Colonel, I would think more than anyone, you've earned the right to an opinion in the current debate as to how to go ahead in Afghanistan. Invest more lives, 40,000 more, or pull back and, you know, either use drones is one of the suggestions. What are your thoughts?
Well, and for what it's worth, I think the United States has created this situation. When my son died, I got a call from the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, who was an old acquaintance. And he offered his condolences, and I said, you know, sir, we need to do something there because we're losing the war. We really need a change in strategy. And he says, yeah, the war in Afghanistan has been a holding action. He said, no, the more proper term would be economy of force for 7 years.
Economy of force.
Which says to me that there is no strategy. So for 7 years, we've had a strategy that was broke in Afghanistan, and the situation continued to decline. And we didn't have the forces, because everybody was focused on Iraq, to pay any attention to Afghanistan. You know, I'm a firm believer that if you're going to go to war, that you got to give it everything you got. And now you have a new guy, General McChrystal, who is there, and he has a different strategy, and it seems to be a sound strategy. And he's asking for 40,000 more. And the administration is again, wringing their hands. So, you know, I lost my son, and one of the reasons these 9 kids were killed is because that theater did not get the resources that they required to do the mission at hand. And so I hope this administration will realize that if you don't resource it, this is the kind of thing that's going to happen.
What about the thinking of pulling out entirely?
I think it's a mistake. You know, I'm for the war in Afghanistan. I lost a son there. And I don't want his death or all the hundreds of other U.S. military that have died there to be in vain.
Colonel Brostrom, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Sure. It's been a pleasure.
Again, David Brostrom, retired Army colonel. His son Jonathan was killed a year ago in Wanat, Afghanistan. A total of 3 military investigations are now looking into what happened. Question for you. Would you sell your life insurance policy for quick cash? Investors are already buying people's life insurance policies, but now Wall Street is trying to bundle and securitize those policies in a new exotic investment to be traded just the way those subprime mortgages were. One commentator is calling it Wall Street's new Halloween trick. Well, we want to learn more about it, but also, is it ever a good idea to sell your insurance policy? Jenny Anderson is a business reporter for the New York Times. She's at the NPR studios in New York. Jenny, just remind us, how does life insurance work?
You buy a policy, and the underwriter promises to give you a benefit at a certain time, maybe upon your death, or maybe the term of the policy, 5, 10, 20 years, but you pay premiums for a certain number of years, and then you expect to get a benefit at the end of that.
Right. But you can, right now, opt out of the life insurance policy, and sort of your insurance agency will let you off the hook and give you some cash?
The way it works now is, say I'm an elderly woman, I want to cash out of my life policy because my kids are grown and I don't think that they need the money. So I go to my life insurance company and they say, we'll give you something called a cash surrender value. But it tends not to be very much money. It can often be less than you've paid in premiums. I have another option, which is to go into the market and try to sell that policy to a life settlement company or a life settlement broker. They'll give me 20 to 200% more than that cash surrender value. So it's really injecting some competition into the marketplace.
Yeah, how new is that?
The life settlement industry says that they've been around since the turn of the century, since a court ruling in 1911 said that your policy is your right to sell just like any other property that you own. But it really took off in the 80s. What happened in the 1980s is a lot of AIDS patients needed to cash out of their life insurance because they were going to die quickly and they needed the cash right away. The surrender values that we just talked about, the cash the life insurance company would give you, was a pittance. And so this industry kind of sprung up out of nowhere and really grew because investors said, okay, I'll buy your policy. I'll give you more. I'll give you $50,000 for that, say, $200,000 policy, and then I get your death benefit. I have to continue paying your premiums until you die. In the 80s, it was called viatical settlements. It had a sort of unfortunate end. It was very good for people and very bad for the investors. What happened was, as the new cocktails were developed to treat people with HIV, people started living longer. And the whole basis of these investments is you set a time frame in which you expect people to die. Because if I'm an investor and I'm buying your policy, you know, I give you the cash, but I have to continue paying your premiums until you die. Say I expect you to die in 2 years, but you live for 20 years, I'm going to end up paying a lot more, and the death benefit isn't going to make up for the cost.
Right. So that already happened in the 80s, as you say, with investors and banks buying the life policies of people with AIDS. But now you say banks are really getting ready to do this again, to buy life policies from the sick and the elderly, but further, do something more with them. So tell us what's happening now.
What's going on now is Wall Street, which has these very big securitization machines, and that just essentially means they take pools of things. They take pools of student loans, pools of mortgages, or in this case, pools of life settlements, and they put them together in one investment and they sell it as a bond. And the effect of that is diversification. If you, an investor, want to buy, say you want to invest in mortgages, you would prefer probably to buy 1,000 mortgages than you would one, because if that one person defaults, you're really out of luck. Now they're doing this with life insurance settlements. They're trying to package a bunch of these into a single bond.
Well, a couple questions. First of all, as we saw with the bundled mortgages, it got so tangled, nobody knew which mortgages were where. And then there were so many subprime, bad mortgages in the mixes that everything just tumbled down. What's the thinking about bundling people's life insurance?
Securitization, the bundling process, I don't think that was the problem in the crisis. The problem was what was being bundled. They were very, very risky mortgages that were bundled. And so when the mortgages went bad, the whole bond went bad.
Right.
So the question here is, are we going to run into the same problem with life settlements? If this market takes off, and this is nascent, I mean, there are a few banks that are considering doing this, they're looking at this, they're waiting for a rating on these bonds. If this takes off, the question is, are the underlying assets good or bad? And it's unclear at this point. I mean, people are bound to die, so you could argue the whole premise of the investment will certainly pan out. But there are a lot of other things could happen if people lived longer than expected, if a cure for cancer, which would be wonderful. If that happened, investors in these products would be in bad shape.
Jenny Anderson, business reporter from the New York Times. Well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll ask our other question. Should you ever sell your life insurance policy if you need quick cash? You know, you might get, let's say, $100,000 instead of the $1.5 million that a life insurance policy promises you, but you might really need that cash, so should you do it? Well, Jenny says beware. They get your phone number. They might be able to call and ask how you're doing. We'll have more with Jenny after a break. Also later, David Letterman apologized to his wife and staff last night, but was that enough? Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking today about life insurance policies, which many people are selling to get quick cash that they need, like for health issues. But these policies may soon also be resold and bundled and sold again on Wall Street in something called a life settlement bond. The SEC has formed a task force to look into the potential investments. The state of Massachusetts is looking into all of this as well. And there was a congressional hearing last month. We're speaking with Jenny Anderson, business reporter for The New York Times. And Jenny, this raises a really ghoulish question. You know, if you have investors who are going to make more money when you don't live a long time, isn't that incentive to make sure people die? You know, it seems like a really morbid equation.
It's a perverse incentive, for sure. But I'm not sure that we've seen instances of people getting knocked off as a result of these yet. I'm not willing to say it's not possible. Anything's possible. But I can tell you one of the things that's happened, which I find particularly unsettling, which is once an individual decides to sell their policy into a settlement, somebody else has their medical records. And actually, somebody is able to call and check to see if you're living. So even if there isn't a person out there sort of with a bat willing to take you out. There is somebody who is checking in with you on a fairly regular basis to sort of see if you're dead yet. And there is something unsavory about that.
And what about insurance companies? How do they feel about this?
Oh, the insurance companies hate this business because right now a huge number of policies lapse or are surrendered. A spouse dies, you miss a few payments, you lose your job, or you die and no one recognizes that there was a death benefit to be realized.
And that means that they don't have to pay out.
That means they don't have to pay out. And so if this industry takes off, that means that investors will be buying these policies and they will be very sure to cash them out. And that is going to be bad for the bottom line of the life insurance company.
Right, which means perhaps that insurance costs will go up for everyone if they're paying out that much more, perhaps.
Right.
Well, as you said, this isn't happening yet, but you learned that, for instance, the bank Credit Suisse is trying to set up what you call a financial assembly line to buy life insurance policies and package and resell them and be positioned for this industry. And this brings us to a familiar, actually, sidebar at this point, how those bundles would be rated. There's been a lot of criticism of the rating companies who rated some of the bundled mortgages, for instance, gave them higher ratings than they deserved. You visited a small rating agency in Manhattan, DBRS. Tell us more about how they're going to tie into this.
Well, there'll be a critical linchpin in all this. And since these haven't been rated yet, it's hard to know how they will come out. DBRS was very, very careful to say, we want to be cautious about this. We're doing all the due diligence we need to do. We're doing sophisticated models that look at what happens if people live many years longer than they're expected to.
They're looking to make sure, for instance, that you wouldn't have all leukemia patients in one bundled, securitized group.
Right. Exactly. You don't want to run into the same problem you did in the 80s and 90s where you had a development for HIV and that suddenly made investors lose money. So they want a diversification of disease.
And they also told you, if I'm reading this correctly, at DBRS, the rating company, that they want the market to flourish in a safe way. But, you know, just the idea that that flourish came first. I'm just wondering, is it the same setup as it was in housing? Are they being paid fees to rate these bundles, and do they then have an incentive to maybe make them look better than they are?
I think the incentive structure is still perverse. It is still skewed. Those who want to get their bonds rated pay for their ratings, and that's a problem.
Well, I just want to jump in and ask, won't there be a predatory sales market that grows up just as we saw happen in housing that preys on these vulnerable people? And it may be hard for them to resist selling a life insurance policy that maybe if they kept, their children could get twice as much money. I mean, do you worry about...
Absolutely. Yeah. This is an industry that's had a lot of problems with fraud. The people who do these transactions charge incredibly high fees, and they don't always disclose those to the people who are selling their policies. So states are getting more aggressive about regulating this particular corner of the market, but it's still a bit of a patchwork of regulation. And I do think seniors need to be very, very careful when thinking about doing it. It can be a great option. If I were 70 years old and ill, and I had a life insurance policy, and my kids were doing well, and I needed some cash, I think it's an excellent option to think about. I just think you have to be very careful about some of the risks, and those risks include high broker fees, they include the licensing of agents, they include just knowing what you're doing and making sure that you have a financial advisor or a lawyer.
Well, also, you say make sure the cash the sellers get is worth it. It could be just a fraction of the policy. But the seller does get cash up front. Then what? What else should the seller worry about?
Well, they have the cash. One of the things they could worry about is, again, this issue of their medical records. When you sell your policy to a life settlement company, they need to see your medical records because they need to be able to do a life expectancy estimate on you. So they have access to your records, and those records effectively become public. So another question that any senior needs to ask when doing this is, what happens to my medical records? Where will they go? Who will have possession of them? Will my medical records be on the internet? Another risk is whether you need insurance after that. Say you sell your life insurance policy because you don't think you need it, and then you decide you do. You might be facing much higher premiums, and you might have a harder time getting insurance. So there are certainly risks to seniors, but it's probably better for them that they have more than one option, that one option being the cash surrender value from a life insurance company, because, you know, monopolies are never a good thing.
And you have to know that there's going to be someone somewhere on Wall Street sort of drumming their fingers saying, is that one gone yet?
Exactly. And, you know, Wall Street's interest in this will always be in big scale, and that's that can be worrisome. You know, they're interested in it is going to be the packaging of it and the sort of moving of product. If you almost think of it in the analogy of a factory, you know, they sort of want to gather, buy up all the product, put it in nice boxes, and then ship it out. So their interests are very differently aligned.
Yeah. You will just be a number. Jenny Anderson, business reporter for The New York Times, speaking to us from the NPR studios in New York about a new exotic investment that Wall Street is pursuing. It involves buying bundled life insurance policies. It hasn't started yet. Jenny, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, looking ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, CNN's legendary war camerawoman, Margaret Moth. The bullets didn't kill her, but the cancer might. And still ahead today, a look at the story behind the story of that American Girl doll. The latest news is next, Here and Now. Silvio Berlusconi, Italy's flamboyant prime minister, has survived sex scandals and corruption charges. Now he may be done in by a law his allies created to protect him. Today, Italy's constitutional court is considering whether that law is legal. It was passed while Berlusconi was on trial on corruption charges to grant him immunity from prosecution while in office. He says it allows him to govern without the distraction of the judiciary. Duncan Kennedy is the BBC's Rome correspondent. Duncan, what happened in court today?
Well, they've gone through the legal arguments today, each side putting their case. And in a nutshell, Mr. Berlusconi's lawyers are saying he should have immunity from prosecution while he's in office. Otherwise, he has, and the word you mentioned there, he has this distraction of the judiciary behind him. He's got a tough enough job as it is. Of course, opponents take a different view to this. They say nobody should be above the law. And they say constitutionally, Mr. Berlusconi doesn't have a leg to stand on.
Well, and by the way, what were the corruption charges?
The main one involved a man called David Mills. It was his British lawyer. Mr. Berlusconi was accused of bribing Mr. Mills to give false evidence in two other cases. Now, David Mills was found guilty and is facing a four-and-a-half-year jail term. So conceivably, if Mr. Berlusconi has immunity withdrawn, he could go back on trial and he too could face charges again of corruption.
And so to be clear, these charges are separate from accusations that Berlusconi has slept with a prostitute. He says he's never paid for sex, has had young girls cavorting naked at his villa. His wife cited his fondness for younger women when she asked recently for a divorce. So there's all this other stuff swirling around Berlusconi as well. What does he say to that?
He doesn't deny that he slept with a prostitute. He absolutely denies that he paid for sex. He makes that fine distinction. He talks about if he paid for sex, that would ruin the thrill of conquest. Mr. Berlusconi has made all sorts of comments talking about his private life, his sex life. He does this at press conferences next to prime ministers and presidents. They all look a bit squeamish and embarrassed. Mr. Berlusconi takes these questions saying, I have done nothing wrong. Morally, I'm on stable ground. But of course, his opponents say this just shows kind of the moral bankruptcy of this regime. The Catholic Church have taken against Mr. Berlusconi on this issue as well. But as far as the publicans are concerned, they're pretty much siding with him.
Well, in fact, some people love him for it, or seem to. One group has written a song about him. Let's listen. Siamo qui per te, cuore anima. I'll do some interpreting. There's a president who's always present. We're here for you, heart and spirit, one voice, Silvio, Silvio, Silvio the Great. And Duncan, we should say that this song is part of a campaign to promote Silvio Berlusconi for the Nobel Peace Prize.
There is a campaign very much on track for that.
Based on what, by the way?
Primarily because of his efforts, self-promoted, it has to be said, by Mr. Berlusconi himself, in bringing the Georgia conflict to an end. He says he acted as a great intermediary between the Russians and the Georgians over the fighting there was there last year. He also talks about his role in bringing Colonel Muammar Gaddafi of Libya in out of the cold. He's serious about this. He believes he has a role on the world stage, and that all this stuff about scandals and immunity is just a sideshow here in Italy, and that he himself should be recognised for the great deeds he's doing.
Well, is it truly a grassroots campaign, or is it one bought by Berlusconi? We're reminded he owns and controls most of the media in Italy, very rich man, and there's been a backlash against that, thousands of people, including reporters, protesting against him this past Sunday. He's fighting back. His family-owned newspaper outed as gay the editor of a Catholic newspaper that had been critical of him. So I guess the question if ultimately the law that's being considered today is overturned and he no longer has immunity, what do you think he'll have to do? Do you think he'll resign?
Mr. Berlusconi himself says he won't resign. He's a stayer. He's not a quitter. So it may indeed come down to his political allies and coalition partners to see if they're going to continue supporting him. The trouble is, there isn't really an alternative to Silvio Berlusconi in Italy. So they might think he's not quite what we wanted, but he's the best of a bad job and we'll sustain him in power.
That's Duncan Kennedy, the BBC's lucky correspondent in Rome, where there's never a dull moment. Duncan, thank you so much.
A pleasure, Robin.
Everybody sing. We just can't get enough of this song for Silvio Berlusconi's campaign for the Nobel Peace Prize. It's called May the Peace. We'll be back in 30 seconds, here and now. You may have heard about the new American Girl doll, you know, the much-mocked homeless doll Gwen. Columnists are having a field day. Andrea Pizer writes in the New York Post, "It seems obscene that a company that prides itself on teaching impressionable children about history should engage in political preaching. What message is being sent with Gwen?" Well, actually, Gwen is sending a message about bullying. And she's not homeless. She's a friend of Krissa, who's actually the main character in the Krissa book from American Girl. Krissa is being bullied and finds out her friend Gwen used to be homeless. Together, they deal with issues of mean girls. Patricia Nix Hodes and Cherry Johnson of the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless recently wrote a blog about all of this. Patricia joins us. And Patricia, the doll's been criticized in a lot of corners. Let's start with the idea that we just heard, that this is somehow a stealth campaign to politically preach to kids.
Well, I don't think it's really politically preaching to raise awareness of the plight of many American children today. Unfortunately, not a historical problem, but a very current one.
Right. And this doll is set in 2009. But still, even though you applaud the awareness, and it's about several pages of the book where Gwen's mom talks about their being homeless in the past, and it brings new awareness to the girls around her, you know, what her life story is and why they maybe shouldn't pick on her. But you are conflicted as well about the fact that homelessness is in a book.
When we first heard of it and we didn't really know the full story, it seemed kind of outrageous in a way. So much money for a doll who was supposed to be homeless, which many families couldn't afford.
And by the way, the American Girl dolls are expensive. They're $95 a doll.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it seemed in a way to be capitalizing on the misfortune of some families. All the while, those families wouldn't even be able to afford such a doll. But then when we thought about it a little more and read about it a little bit more, we thought, really, a book that raises the issues that may teach other kids about what some kids are experiencing today isn't a bad thing. And there really are many children's books that cover experiences of homelessness, but we would hope that maybe there could be more taught to children through the book or through other things American Girl might do, how children could help with the problem of homelessness and how maybe the corporate community could assist as well.
Well, by the way, you know, past dolls, Addie, the very popular American Girl doll, escaped from slavery in 1864. That was her story. There was another doll that was a Native Indian girl and had her struggles in her life. What do you say to parents who say, "I don't want any doll that has a problem"?
I think that children learn through play. So I think dolls and toys and children's books are an excellent way to teach them about some of the reality that's going on in the world today. There's so much outrage about the doll, but where's the outrage about all the actual children that are living in homelessness?
That's Patricia Nix Hodes of the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless. By the way, we'll put your information at our website, hereandnow.org. Patricia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And this quick note, in the last 19 years, American Girl says they've given $9 million worth of clothing and books to Kids in Distress Situations. That's a global charity for homeless kids. And they recently partnered with the Ophelia Project. That's a Pennsylvania-based charity dedicated to helping kids deal with bullying. Well, David Letterman apologized on air last night to his wife for those office affairs before they were married, but during their decades of on-and-off dating. Letterman said she's been horribly hurt, and he has his work cut out for him.
I'll be honest with you, folks. Right now, I would give anything to be hiking on the Appalachian Trail.
David said even the GPS lady in his car won't talk to him. But some think the bigger question is Letterman out of hot water with CBS? Will women he dated come forward to say they felt coerced, or more likely, will employees come forward to say they felt cut out of the fun? David's affairs, one of them, Stephanie Burkett, who also later dated the man accused of extorting Letterman, was given coveted on-air time. Paul Farhi is style reporter for The Washington Post. Paul, Letterman did apologize to his staff last night. Do we know of any staffers coming forward who weren't happy with his behavior?
No, we don't. And that's probably the key to this. There's no one who has come forward with a sexual harassment allegation. These are, from all appearances, consensual relationships. So the question becomes, what other shoes are there to drop?
Well, and some would say that even without shoes dropping, you know, if somebody's in that senior position, a position of that much power, there still is an unfairness to it, and many companies ban that kind of relationship.
That's a fair point, and I think that is going to be the charge leveled against him. But it doesn't necessarily equate to a lawsuit or warrant any kind of disciplinary action necessarily by CBS. Remember that David Letterman is in some ways an independent contractor of CBS, so he's probably not subject to the disciplinary guidelines of CBS.
Well, Gerald Schargel, who's the lawyer representing Joel Halderman, the man who's accused of extorting David Letterman, Schargel says he has evidence of sexual harassment and he's going to present it in the courtroom.
Yes, and we'll wait to see that. Right. Defense lawyers will throw as much as they can out there.
Schargel saying that Halderman read the diaries of Stephanie Burkett, again, who was the assistant to David Letterman before she was the girlfriend to Joel Halderman, and they're saying that there was something in those diaries, as you said. We'll have to wait and see.
I think that in some ways might be the key. I mean, what was Letterman talking about on Thursday when he suggested his behavior was creepy? It may well just be that he engaged in relationships with members of his staff, and that doesn't look very good. But again, whether that's the beginning and end of it is what we're going to find out once we get to a trial.
Do you think either CBS or Worldwide Pants, Letterman's company, will launch an internal investigation? Do we know if they're thinking of that?
We haven't heard of that. It wouldn't surprise me. But here's the other thing is Letterman makes so much money for CBS that it's going to be hard for CBS to really push him around.
Well, the other thing is that he's hugely liked. And as people in our office have pointed out, he doesn't need to go on Oprah to confess his sins. He's got his own show, so he doesn't have to do any interviews outside of the show. And some would say he's doing quite well. He's been groveling. He's been apologetic. And as we said, no young women have come forward to complain. So does that perhaps help him?
Yes, it helps him greatly. He has an enormous advantage over anybody else in this situation because he can put out his side of the story without allowing any kind of question or any kind of response. And millions of people like him, they're predisposed to believing him as well.
Paul Farhi, style reporter for The Washington Post. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any story. Just go to hereandnow.org. You can click on Contact Us up on the right to send an email or make a phone call. Or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage, hereandnow.org. Before we go today, Nashville Music Award nominees, the Gabe Dixon Band, in 1 minute, Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. Music City will be hopping this week. The winners of the Nashville Music Awards will be announced during the next big Nashville Music Festival tomorrow night. Among the nominees in the Best Pop Rock Album are The Kings of Leon, their record Only by the Night.
I've been roaming around, always looking down at all I see.
Singer-songwriter Erin McCarley's latest CD, it's called Love Save the Empty.
Little girls don't know how to be sweet girls. Mama didn't teach me.
And there's also an entry from the Gabe Dixon Band.
Well, I feel no pain when you are around me. That's why I run as fast as I can.
That's the song Sirens by the Gabe Dixon Band from their self-titled CD. The band features Gabe Dixon on piano, Winston Harrison on bass, Jana Ricks on drums. They got together as students at the University of Miami, but along the way, Gabe Dixon has done some very high-profile moonlighting, including an appearance with Paul McCartney at the Concert for New York after the 9/11 attacks. After that, Paul McCartney, now this is Sir Paul McCartney, offered Gabe the keyboard slot on his world tour, and Gabe turned him down. So when we spoke last fall, I had to ask Gabe first, what were you thinking?
Well, that was not an easy decision because I love Paul and his music, and he was such a huge, huge influence on me as a musician. And, you know, I just was faced with a situation where I had a record that had just been finished, was about to be released on a major label. We had tour dates booked, and I kind of had to decide, well, what is it what I really want to do with my life? What do I really, what really brings me alive? And so after a lot of prayer and meditation and thought about it, I decided that I needed to go for my own dreams.
So big decision for you, and it seems to have paid off because critics are just loving your CD. The newspaper in your hometown, The Tennessean, compared your new CD to early Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan, Carole King, and James Taylor.
I'll gladly sit in that company anytime because those are some of the greatest songwriters and artists ever, you know.
Well, and how would you define your sound? Because we know you come from Nashville. Is it Nashville, influence? I mean, how would you describe it?
Well, it's definitely Nashville influenced. It might not be the Nashville that has presented itself to be in the last several decades, but, you know, I grew up in Nashville, so I saw a different Nashville than I think the rest of the world necessarily knows about. I grew up going to Blair School of Music at Vanderbilt and got to watch people like Bela Fleck and the great classical folks there. And, you know, Nashville has a great blues and funk and rock scene. So that's sort of the side of Nashville that I was immersed in growing up.
And we can hear it in your music. And we also hear your strong feelings about home in your music as well. At least three songs talk about going home, or finding your way home, or being far from home. Let's listen to one. This is Five More Hours.
I'm almost home. I got five more hours of highway. Five more hours to go. Five more hours of highway till I'm in the place I know. Heaven only knows the time I've wasted. So close now, I can almost taste it.
Five More Hours, a song about leaving New York, going back to Nashville. And it sounds like some sort of turning point. Are we hearing that as well? Or?
Yeah. Well, you know, I grew up in Nashville and kind of went off to school in Miami and met my band and went up to New York. And we, you know, kind of, it was sort of this grand adventure, odyssey. And in the end, I realized that I needed to go back home and sort of restart.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, what came from that, you know, the idea of regrouping. You now have this band. Tell me about their sound. There's no guitar, we think, but your bandmate Winston Harrison plays something like a guitar, a mandotar,
yeah.
Oh.
It's an instrument that he just kind of took a guitar and modified it to have four strings and tuned it like a mandolin.
Is there a place where we can hear this converted guitar? Is there a song you'd recommend?
The most interesting stuff he does is on Sirens.
Gabe, now I want to ask you about your playing on the piano. You know, we can, not that it's derivative, but we can hear some Bruce Hornsby, we hear Elton John. Who influenced you?
Early 70s, Elton John, the Beatles, and, you know, a lot. I kind of just started with my parents' record collection, to be honest. They had a lot of great albums from that era. You know, Paul Simon, Still Crazy After All These Years, I remember wearing that record out, and, you know, Ray Charles and Joe Cocker and, you know, Joni Mitchell, the band, Allman Brothers, you know, that's sort of where I started to discover music on my own. And as far as piano players go, honestly, Reese Winans was a huge influence on me. He played with Stevie Ray Vaughan and has gone on to play with a lot of other folks. And he's a Nashville native, so I used to sneak down to the Bluebird Cafe, which was right down the street from where I grew up, and watch him play in bands there, and just studied what he did. And he's such a great, like, boogie-woogie blues kind of piano player. Him and Chuck Lavelle and Matt Rawlings, who was another great Nashville piano player, Dr. John, those were my early piano influences. And then, of course, I went to college and got more into some jazz stuff, you know, Keith Jarrett and Bill Evans and folks like that. And I'm constantly discovering new things that hopefully filter in somehow to what I do.
Well, let's hear how they get through that filter until you're gone. Well, Gabe Dixon, you were talking about being influenced musically by your parents' record collection, and I'm wondering if you were influenced by the records, because the picture on the cover of the new CD, the Gabe Dixon Band, shows you and the band members standing on the front porch of an old house, and it looks so much like that cover of the first Crosby, Stills, and Nash album. They're sitting on an old couch on the porch of some dilapidated house, and I'm just wondering, was that deliberate?
It was deliberate. Not necessarily that we wanted to copy that specific photo, but we did find the guy who took the photo, Henry Diltz, who's just a wonderful photographer and a wonderful guy. And we said, gosh, you know, we love the photos he's done. He did that, the one of Crosby, Stills, and Nash. He did the Morrison Hotel by the Doors. Right. He did a bunch of classic albums. And we said, let's send him the album and see if he likes it and see if he'd agree to, you know, spend the day with us shooting some photos, and sure enough, he did, and we're really glad we got to have that experience with him. And I'm really happy with how it turned out.
Well, you know, you just got me to Google the Henry Diltz website, and there's Joni Mitchell looking out of the window on that cover.
Oh, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous photo.
Yep, and there's the young Bob Dylan with the harmonica to his lips, and there's Jimi Hendrix with the jacket with the, what do you call it, the tassels around it. Oh, Paul and Linda hugging. I mean, yeah, these are iconic photos, and it's not there now, but maybe someday the Gabe Dixon Band will be on that homepage, too. The song Disappear from the CD, The Gabe Dixon Band, the CD, one of the nominees for Best Pop Rock Album at the Nashville Music Awards tomorrow night. We spoke with Gabe last October. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Nellie Mae Education Foundation, presenting sponsor of the Grantmakers for Education National Conference this week in Chicago, featuring Education Secretary Arne Duncan.
PRI, Public Radio International.